Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
A claim yesterday that there could be 7,000 deaths if the borders were open, but only 80% of those over age five, are vaccinated, is proven controversial. Health authorities in Auckland are working overtime to boost vaccination rates quickly amid an ongoing outbreak in the region, but modeller Sean Hendy said at a daily 1pm COVID briefing that even if just 80% get the jab, it may still not be enough in future to prevent the health system from being overwhelmed.
Our healthcare system couldn't cope with this level of illness. We would need to continue to use lockdowns. The message from the modelling is that COVID-19 is going to continue to disrupt our lives for some time yet, but that we can minimise that disruption by ensuring we all get vaccinated.
He emphasised that 80% vaccinated, New Zealanders would be vulnerable.
We haven't had large numbers of infections here, so we haven't banked that natural immunity that the other places such as the UK have.
Well, those comments have upset a fellow COVID analyst, Rodney Jones, who says the data and suggestions are unhelpful. He joins us now. Good morning.
Yeah, morning.
Why have you taken such a strong view on this? What is wrong with getting this information out in front of New Zealanders so they can make an informed decision?
Because you can't fight fear with fear. If people are reluctant to get vaccinated, we need to encourage them. We need to kind of explain. We need to, you know, build a narrative where they feel they're part of a process. If we scare them, it doesn't work. That's what we recognise.
Well, why doesn't it work? I mean, surely we saw in the recent outbreak that with people thinking that there was COVID there, that people did rush out to get vaccinated.
So yes, people will make their own decisions, but you have to keep the government credibility. You have to keep the credibility of the political leadership, and we have to maintain social cohesion. The problem with these numbers is that it's just all over-egged. It's the internal consistency is not there. We just can't throw out big numbers and say, you know, the world's going to end if we don't get vaccinated. We have to get vaccinated. We need the most vaccinated, but we have to have a fact-based discussion.
What's wrong with the modelling itself, the mechanism, if you like, has been peer-reviewed? If we look overseas, we are seeing 2,000 people die a day in the US. That's a real-life outcome of a country which hasn't got that high vaccination rate it needs.
Yes. So the 7,000 number got the attention. The more realistic part of their model is where they get 75% of New Zealand vaccinated, of all population. That is more implausible. But even in that case, they still have 5,000 deaths. They have 2,500 cases a day. That's more cases in one day than we've had this entire outbreak. People are just not, that's just not going to happen. So why put it out there?
And that's not going to happen because, as Sean Hendy did say, there at that point, you would be having lockdowns. The border would presumably be much tighter.
Yes. So why put it out there? We're going to be living life differently. It's making false assumptions. It's making assumptions that we have no restrictions. We all ignore COVID. None of us are rational. We behave like rabbits. And we have 20 to 30% of the population in one year getting infected.
But isn't it useful to know where we stand? To know that if we get to 90%, these are our options. It puts it into the future.
But we know that anyway. We know that anyway. We don't need to put out these big numbers and try and scare people through big numbers. We know if we get vaccinated, we have a much better path. It's like saying a year ago, 80,000 would die was unhelpful. We knew what we needed to do in the next 4, 6, 8 weeks. You know, the reality of COVID is we live in a world of uncertainty. We can't, and that uncertainty leaves a void. We can't fill that void just with modelling.
Well, let me push back on that, because some might argue that the 80,000 figure was helpful because it informed the government, and I guess they took a very strong approach, and we had kept with the elimination strategy, which has proved very successful for New Zealand.
Yes, and I was an early arguer for lockdown, and our modelling said New Zealand was going to run out of ICU beds around mid-April. That was compelling enough. You didn't need to over-egg the numbers. Keep it simple, and the risk of COVID has been very clear. Exaggerate, and you cause dissension. Just keep it simple. We know what we need to do. We don't need to introduce this complexity into the narrative.
Let me just put a couple of things that Sean Hendy has said in response to you. He argues, say, for example, well, I think in Singapore, they have more ICU beds, so that would obviously change the modelling a little bit. And New Zealand has a different population. We have different demographics.
Yeah, we're also more dispersed. We have areas of concentrated. Singapore is one of the densest cities on Earth. And then they have their foreign workers who live in dormitories who are included in the numbers. We're very dispersed. We've maintained a high level of social cohesion. We know what we need to do. We're feeling our way down this darkened hallway. We can continue to do so. We've adapted to Delta. It was clear it was going to, in my view, it was going to be difficult to eliminate. That's proved the case. But we're kind of hanging in there. So I still don't see that throwing big numbers around helps our narrative, particularly when the assumptions, when we look at this modelling, it's as if we're not vaccinated. The case fatality rate, the number of hospitalizations, is far higher in this model than we're seeing in Singapore or elsewhere right now. It's like a pre-vaccination outcome.
So should we not have done the modelling?
No, the modelling's fine, but the modelling is not the answer. It's actually time for modelling to step back. Modelling was great early in the outbreak, but we have world experts on how to manage outbreaks. This is a highly technical field, and so people with expertise who have jumped in, like myself or like Sean, it's time for us to step back. We actually need people who spend their whole time studying TB outbreaks, other sorts of outbreaks, to actually lead the discussion on this. This is complicated.
Just finally, do you think we can? Do you think we can get to 90%? And in particular, do you think Māori and Pacific communities can get to 90%?
We have to work with them to get that. If they don't, the younger people are resistant. It's just going to take time, and using fear is not going to help. And we realize we're going to go through these. It's going to be an iterative process. We're not going to get there at the first shot. It's going to take many shots, and it's going to take calmly working with people.
Roddy Jones, thank you very much for that. COVID analyst there has provided expert analysis of his own through to the government during this COVID pandemic.
The Mount Albert community in Auckland is shocked and upset at the violent death of a vulnerable young woman near Owairaka Domain. 27-year-old Lena Zhang Harap, who has Down syndrome, failed to return home after going out for a walk on Wednesday morning. Her body was found that afternoon in bush off a walkway, and the police have launched a homicide investigation. Chen Liu reports.
Flowers and cars kept coming at the entrance to the Mount Albert or Wairaka Domain, where Lena Zhang normally took her walks. Lucy Leslie brought flowers from her garden. She works in special education and is devastated by what has happened.
It's really important for people with special needs to be given independence and to have this end so badly. Really just is worst case scenario and not fair at all. These people should feel protected at all costs.
Another local, Sabre Eustace, now has questions about how safe the neighbourhood is.
We would assume everybody in our area is friendly and of good nature. Now we don't really want to be out walking if this is what's going on in our community.
Michael Field says he would pass Miss Zhang a couple of times a week on top of Mount Albert.
I sort of marked her as an independent kind of woman, and although she clearly had issues, she was stoic and strong in her own way. And to have this happen to one of us on the Maunga, our Maunga, is just horrible.
Kay McGarry feels shattered and says her heart breaks for the family.
We're all here, we're all still strong, we're still walking here. We're not letting this, stop us keeping her memory alive by keeping walking here and making sure we think of her.
The police are appealing for information about a man they say is of interest. He's described as dark-skinned, boarding with a distinctive mark on his forehead. He was wearing a mask and a blue jumper.
About 300 people gathered outside the Timaru home where the three South African sisters were killed a week ago yesterday. At the candlelight vigil last night, a message was read out from the father of the three young girls. Colin Young was there.
The vigil for the Dickerson children, Maya and Carla, age 2, and Leonie, 6, was organised to happen at the same time as one in the family's hometown of Pretoria. While Fakaria Mai played in Timaru, A World Away in South Africa, How Great Thou Art was sung in English. Reverend Alan Cummins, who has been offering support to the girl's father, Graham Dickerson, read a letter from him.
Dear people of Timaru, my words are few at the moment. On Thursday, the 16th of September, 2021, my life and Lauren's was turned upside down when our three precious angels were ripped away from us.
Graham Dickerson says the support he's received from people in Timaru has restored his faith in humanity. And he has this message for those affected by the tragedy.
Look after yourself. Look after your wives, your husbands, your partners. Look after your children. For those with faith in Jesus Christ, hold on to that. For the parents with young kids, remember them. Remember to let them run free. Remember to let them play wild. Allow them to laugh as much as they can.
A letter was also read from the girl's grandmother, Graham's mother, Betty Dickerson, who says she's struggling to comprehend how this could have happened. She shared a little bit about who the girls were, starting with Leanne.
Graham shared with us a video clip after her first day at school, and she seemed so excited about the new friends she had made. This happy memory will always stay with us. We feel sure that she would have loved growing up in this wholesome and caring community.
Then there were the twins.
Maya was our little bag lady, always gathering dolls and toys, carrying them around her in her little handbags. Carla was the brave one. Born with a cleft lip, she didn't have the best start in life, but she overcame that and ended up developing into a daring explorer.
Reverend Cummins says Graham Dickerson is bearing up as well as can be expected under the circumstances.
Thanks to his prayer support, he's a great, very committed Christian. He's doing remarkably well, I suppose you'd say, and good friends around him, good support, people reaching out to him, so that's good. Long way to go, of course, long way to go, but good steps in the right direction.
The vigil was organised by Jacqueline Harris, who got in touch with the family in South Africa to make sure it was done in accordance with their wishes. She also helped out just 6 weeks ago when five teens were killed in a crash, cooking meals for the families involved.
Our community has suffered a lot in the last few weeks, and I think that everybody needed something and something to give them faith. And I think this is it. And it shows just how family-orientated our entire community is because they've come together greatly for this family.
Graham Dickerson's sister has flown here from South Africa to lend him support and will be at his side once she finishes her time in MIQ. Meanwhile, the girl's mother, Lauren Dickerson, has been charged with their murder and will appear in court again on October the 5th.
Government figures suggest taxpayers paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to accommodate visiting sports teams last year. Documents provided to RNZ show every member of a cricket team that stayed in MIQ was calculated to cost $15,000 more than the team actually paid. Every member of a visiting rugby team was projected to cost $10,000 more than the agreed fee. Last month, the freebies ended, and the government started charging sports teams the full cost of their MIQ stay. Our MIQ reporter Katie Todd says sports teams cost more than a regular MIQ stayer.
A typical New Zealander wanting to come home normally pays $3,100, about half the total cost of their estimated MIQ stay. And up until the beginning of August, sports teams were charged $7,000 per member. That's players, coaches, medics, everyone on the team. That difference is because they tend to take up more room and they need to travel to get to specially isolated training facilities. The Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment says sports teams can also get tailored meals, more frequent laundry, more security, and additional cleaning. Sports teams actually come into the country under critical worker exemptions.
But do these documents suggest that the $7,000 per sports person is not enough? So the actual cost might be a lot higher?
The confidential briefing is from September last year, and in it, officials lay out estimated MIQ costs of three events, the Rugby Championship, the Summer of Cricket, and Netball's Constellation Cup. It is a high-level paper asking for action from a range of cabinet ministers. Evaluating the events, it estimates the true cost of sports team MIQ stays could be double or even triple what the teams were asking to be charged. When the hotel, transport, training facility and staff fees were added up, the estimated cost for a rugby team came out at $17,000 per person, and for cricket it was $22,000 per person. That difference explained by the lower number of cricket players visiting and the fact that some costs remain fixed. Now, I'll use an example to try and make this clearer. If we consider the Wallabies and know that they had 65 people stay in MIQ, each paying $7,000, that means the government's own estimate for that trip, that is the shortfall that the taxpayer has to cover, comes in at more than $500,000. So we have to remember these are estimate figures. The actual costs will have varied. RNZ has contacted MB asking for a breakdown of how much the 13 international sports teams that visited the country since September last year have actually cost.
But the government would argue that the expense of these teams visiting the country is more than offset by benefits.
Yes, to get across the border in the first place, the sporting codes had to prove that their events would give the country an economic boost. These documents show the Rugby Championship was estimated to bring at least $26 million in economic benefits, Summer of Cricket was estimated to generate about $19.3 million, and Netball's Constellation Cup, $2.6 million. That might go some way to explaining why the government agreed to subsidise the team's MIQ stays. It is worth noting that ministers were told, quote, there may be demand from other sports codes and industry groups for similar subsidised bespoke MIQ proposals.
There are more teams on their way. How much will they pay?
Another batch of cricket, rugby and netball teams are set to arrive in the country between November and March, using more than 500 MIQ rooms. It's unclear how many of them will need special arrangements like access to training facilities and who will have a normal MIQ stay. But MB says these sports teams will be charged on a cost recovery model. That means no more subsidy. They'll be invoiced for all extra costs they incur.
To rugby, tomorrow night, the All Blacks and Springboks play the 100th test between the two nations in what many believe is the greatest rivalry in rugby. There have been thrilling matches, watershed series victories, World Cup triumphs and, of course, controversy, including the infamous 1976 and 1981 tours. Rugby reporter Joe Porter looks back at some of that history ahead of this weekend's centenary test, which is being held in Townsville due to the COVID pandemic.
The 1995 World Cup final wasn't the most memorable of matches, but the result was as South Africa beat the All Blacks at a time when something was desperately needed to unite the nation just a few years after apartheid was abolished. In 1976, the All Blacks were sent to apartheid South Africa to tour, with the Māori members of the team made honorary whites. Andy Leslie was All Blacks captain.
In Cape Town, and the guys got the tear gas, and they were walking down the streets, and there was a tear gas attack and all that. And I can remember Kirky and them coming back to the hotel, and they were in the middle of it.
After the tour, Leslie described South Africa as a country at war, and the tour led to protests and 25 African nations boycotting the 1976 Olympics in Montreal. However, the number eight says the rivalry between the two countries has never faltered.
They were the team to beat. You know, All Blacks playing the Springboks in the day, they were your World Cup finals.
Leslie's love affair with All Blacks and Springboks rugby goes back to childhood.
I can remember sitting on the sideline on a plank of wood at Athletic Park, and Tommy von Vollenhoffen was playing on the wing, and he just about landed on our laps.
Leslie also remembers the 1956 tour here by the Springboks, where New Zealand were after revenge following the previous series loss in South Africa. The All Blacks would claim a 3-1 series win as prop and New Zealand heavyweight boxing champion Kevin Skinner was called out of retirement for the final two tests.
just the loveliest, quietest spoken man with such a reputation. You wondered whether it was all true, but he's a very, very strong man.
And obviously he really took it to the box forwards, didn't he? He made sure none of the All Blacks got pushed around.
Yeah, swapped over the side of the scrum and looked after most things, I think.
While New Zealanders celebrated the 1956 series, they were divided by the 1981 tour by the Springboks. Apartheid had made South Africa an international outcast, and many New Zealanders didn't want to have any sporting contact with the country.
Smoke bombs, flares, and an attempt to come onto the field.
It led to protests and clashes with police as more than 150,000 people took part in over 200 demonstrations around Aotearoa. Graham Murray was All Black captain, but made himself unavailable for the tour.
South Africa disenfranchised 80% of the population from ever being able to represent their country in rugby. You know, as All Blacks, we always used to talk about the need to be able to get up and look at yourself in the mirror the day after a test match, and I think it was the right moral decision to make.
After the tour, in which two games were cancelled due to the protests, the All Blacks wouldn't play the Springboks again until apartheid had been abolished in the 1990s. It took until 1996 for the All Blacks to first win a series in South Africa, but the rivalry since has leaned New Zealand's way, with the All Blacks winning 32 of the last 43 tests. The Springboks are coming off two losses to the Wallabies, and the All Blacks are favourites to win tomorrow night's centenary test and seal the Rugby Championship crown. However, Beauden Barrett, who will start at first five, says they won't be complacent.
You know, a wounded Springbok is quite dangerous.
The Springboks will need to be at their most dangerous in Townsville, where they must win with a bonus point to keep their slim title chances alive.
Few people who upload their drawing to the internet expect their work to be picked up by a Donald Trump fundraising committee. That's exactly what happened to one Wellington-based graphic designer whose illustration of a golden eagle has become the logo of the official Trump card. The card is presented to supporters who donate at least 64 New Zealand dollars worth, that's 45 US, to Trump's fundraising efforts. The designer's David Peters, he's on the line. Kia ora.
Hello.
How did you find out about this?
Someone from The Insider reached out and said, I'm reaching out about the fact that what appears to be your illustration of a golden eagle is being used by the Donald Trump campaign for their official Trump card. Do you have any comment?
And what was your comment?
Well, at the time, I wanted to keep a really low profile and I didn't want to talk about it publicly. But I think it's such a funny story that it's worth telling.
Why did you want to keep a low profile about it?
No reason in particular. Just I can't see much good coming of going public about it, being associated with Trump and all.
Your design, though, has been picked up by public figure. So I suppose that in itself, it's going to get a fair amount of exposure, is it not?
Yeah, assuming I can plug my outfit.
And how does this work? So you did this drawing for some other reason. Tell us about how this process kind of worked.
Yeah, okay. So about 7 years ago, I had this little design studio and a chap approached me because he wanted a massive eagle emblazoned on the bonnet of his car. So we did the design, coordinated the print and had it stuck to his car and he drove away happy. So there's somewhere out there in Wellington, there's a great big eagle on the hood of somebody's car and that eagle is now on Donald Trump's official Trump card.
Okay, so you uploaded it to the internet, what, thinking, oh, I might get a few other people might download this and I might get a bit of extra payment for it. How did that go over the years?
So I retained the rights to it afterwards. So I put it on Shutterstock and over the course of about 7 years, it earned about $224 US. So I think that boiled down to about 56 US cents per download. And Trump will have paid something like, or his campaign would have paid something like $3 US.
$3?
Yeah. If he didn't get it for free, which I think you can do if you've just signed up for an account, you can download stuff for free with your initial free credit. So his campaign has paid either nothing or about $3 for this asset.
I mean I'm sort of, It's kind of amazing to think that this is how it's done, or is this how it's done? If you're putting together some graphic design work, is this what you would do if you were a major public figure?
as a graphic designer or as Trump? Absolutely not. I mean, well, I just think it really highlights his disdain for even his own supporters and like just how cheap this is. I mean, he hasn't employed a real person to design something special for his official card. Like, he has to find it on Shutterstock. And that's the way he goes about it. I don't know. It's surreal, but it's also completely tracks with everything that we know about him.
I'm sure it is special, though. He obviously thought it was special, or his campaign team did.
He did. His people did as well, I guess, because it went out to vote. It was actually one of four designs that were put out to be voted on, and his supporters voted on this one.
So you got the popular vote.
Yeah.
There you go. It's a big American eagle, I guess, or that's the sort of thing that it looks like, and it is gold. I had a look at it on the internet this morning. Are you concerned that this is, you know, the eagle has been used by, amongst others, you know, the Nazis in the past? Is this worrying from your perspective that you're getting perhaps associated with something that was never the intent?
No, I mean, the, you know, extreme lefties and extreme righties will all have, you know, ridiculous spins on things. And this is one from the left where, grasping at straws, they're likening it to iconography from the Third Reich. And, yep, it looks very, very similar. But it's also an American eagle. So I think they're grasping at straws a little bit. And as for how it reflects on me, I've got no concerns whatsoever, because it was designed for the hood of somebody's car, and it's an American eagle, and that's as far as it goes.
Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate you talking to us. David Peters there, who has unintentionally, I suppose, designed the logo of the official Trump card. And I wonder where that car is.
Yeah, has anyone out there seen it?
If you know where the car is with the eagle on the bonnet, 2101 on the text.
Yeah, cool story, bro, as they say. Now, builders are learning that desperate times require desperate measures, but woe betide if they take a shortcut. Councils and a lawyer are warning that a rising tide of people wanting to alter their building consent can bring big problems with it. Phil Pennington reports.
The newly expanded building team at the busiest little council in the country, Selwyn District, faces a flood. Not only does it rank just third behind Auckland and Christchurch for new house numbers, with consents pouring in at almost 2,000 a month, or a fifth above last year, but hot on their heels are coming the requests to amend those consents. Tim Harris leads the 30-strong team.
They can't just get the materials that they had been approved for their building consent, so a lot of inquiries. Anything from plasterboards, trusses and frames, down to things like handles.
Substitutions can be made for many materials, and some minor variations can even be made on site. But others require amendment and council sign-off. Selwyn is aiming to do those in 10 working days, half the time for a full consent. But in reality, Harris's team is hard-pressed.
The more workarounds, the more variations, the more amendments we get, that actually is extra work for us on top of the volume of new applications coming through the door. That's why we're trying to talk to our people really early on and saying, look, you might have some issues sourcing this material and you need to think about what you're going to do.
The builders coming in the door may face delays, especially if they left it late. And that's quite likely, given it's only becoming clear day by day just how severe and long-lasting the supply shortages could be, with some merchants now refusing to accept major orders unless the builder can wait till next year. However, it's those builders who don't ask but sub out products anyway, out of desperation, say, that really worry Harris.
We're all in this together, but the builders under the pump got customers yelling at them, and they, in some cases, are looking for shortcuts that sometimes backfire on them. If they've used something that hasn't been approved, they might struggle to get their certificate of compliance.
At scores of jobs, maybe a tenth of the 1,800 inspections they do a month in Selwyn, his inspectors are running into problems just like this. A recent industry webinar heard from people urging architects to do a better job of specifying what's needed so that suppliers can match that. Matthew Duda of networking company EBOS says the other suggestion is for more flexibility.
Can we effectively have more options for people to, if there are delays, that they've actually got some choice?
Tim Harris at Selwyn says council's hands are largely tied because of the building code and liability. Lawyer Tanya Wood, a partner at Duncan Cottrell, warns against builders just trying it on.
Bill to take the risk that the council didn't deem it to be a minor variation, and then council couldn't retrospectively issue an amendment to the building consent.
Everyone is facing what Wood calls a perfect storm of supply, labour and consenting pressures that is upping the risk of delays while lowering the margins that builders get paid from.
You need to understand your ability to be able to get that substitution made with the client and or council, and if there's delays caused by having to substitute a product, then understanding whether you're entitled to what's called an extension of time under your contract.
Architects suggest builders have a pre-application chat with councils. Selwyn is innovating by fast-tracking consents for designers, builders and developers who meet certain criteria. Other innovations are also appearing. Merchants are typically now only supplying major orders for frames and roof trusses to jobs that already have their consents in place. This has been done not to combat stockpiling, as most frames and trusses are bespoke for the individual job, but to help ensure those who are the most ready to build are getting priority.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.